Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. We're recording this episode on Tuesday, February 24th, 2016, at approximately 2:26 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 64th episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes while getting some great subscriber benefits, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with Kelly Surtees and Austin Coppock about the significations of the seven traditional planets. So let's get right to it. Kelly and Austin, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Chris. Thanks.
All right. I'm excited about this episode. So the genesis of this episode is that I've been working on the chapter of my book for most of this month on Hellenistic astrology that deals with the significations of the planets and the original significations of the planets in what is essentially one of the earliest forms of Western astrology. So I thought you two would be great people to talk about in order to discuss some of the core fundamental meanings of the seven traditional planets and where we get some of those meanings from or what they're derived from, and to kind of have maybe an hour-long discussion exploring that topic. Let's see. So the starting point of this is actually, I just finished earlier this month, I finalized a translation of the first chapter of the anthology of Vedius Valens, where he gives the significations of the planets. And it took me a while. It's something I've been working on off and on for 5 or 6 years now. But basically, in Valens, he has a separate section for each of the seven planets, and then he just lists off at like 100 significations or 100 different meanings that are associated with each of those planets. And it's interesting because some of them are sort of individual isolated meanings that are obviously coming from some broad overarching archetype. Other meanings are ones that are part of a series that are tied into or contrast in some way with other planets. So I thought that would be partially a good starting point for discussing the meanings of each of these planets and sort of getting a sense for how they can be used as a unit or as a set on their own. One of the things I think that's changing is that typically in modern astrology, in the late 20th century, the planets were, you know, the 9 or 10 planetary bodies that go out through Neptune and Pluto. But in ancient times and in traditional astrology, the planets were the seven traditional celestial bodies that you can see with the naked eye. And I think a lot of astrologers are starting to go back to looking at that distinction of planets that you can see with the naked eye as an important or significant distinction that sets the seven traditional planets in a category of their own. Did you guys make that transition at some point, or how do you deal with, do you see there as being a distinction between the seven traditional planets versus the outer planets, or do you otherwise not really view that as a distinction?
Totally. I totally see that there's a difference. I did make a switch, I guess, fairly early in my practice. And that switch had to do with taking the outer planets out as sign rulers primarily. And I think one of the big differences is that the seven original or traditional planets are visible to the naked eye. So to my mind, that we experience them differently versus the modern or outer planets, which we need an intermediary, like a piece of technology, to connect with or to view. So there's a qualitative difference, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important distinction from a symbolic standpoint, where in the ancient world, where they were talking about different forms of divination, of which astrology was one, but also other forms of divination, of which we still have some forms of today, like, you know, like tarot card reading or tea leaf reading or palmistry, the observational, the thing that you can see that's visible to the observer and the specific way that it appears to the observer has important symbolic implications for the phenomenon that's being discussed. And I think that's where the visible versus not visible distinction comes into play when it comes to the planets.
Hugely so.
Yeah. You know, my transition from regarding Uranus and Neptune and Pluto as sort of part of exactly the same set occurred in pretty much exactly the same way that Kelly described. I ceased using them as sign rulers, although I'm still very interested in aspects to them, either transiting or natal. I would say that visibility is, of course, the most important component. That visibility, the possibility of being seen by the naked eye. But at the same time, we do have to remember that, you know, we look at the traditional planets even when we can't see them, right? You know, we're interested in the fact that Saturn is in the third in a chart, even though Saturn was not visible to the naked eye. You know, in astrology, as opposed to the types of sortilege that you were describing, like with cards, you don't read the cards that don't come up, right? Whereas in astrology, that distinction between visibility and invisibility is very important because both say something. If Mercury is too close to the sun to be seen, that actually gives us information, right? Like invisibility is a sign in astrology, which is, a relatively unique part of its symbolic language as opposed to palmistry. You don't read the lines that aren't there on the hand, whereas we look in particular at who is missing.
Definitely. Yeah, it's interesting that both of you say that your access point for this was the modern rulerships, because that was actually my access point as well. And I mean, I was very resistant to the idea of traditional rulerships. And I think that's the biggest thing that people get stuck on initially in wanting to deal with or differentiate between the traditional planets and the outer planets, to the extent that I was almost like militantly resistant to that idea, like Charlton Heston, like, pry them from my cold, dead hands type.
Well, we all know why. It's because you're a Scorpio and you got to have Pluto and all the cool Plutonian stuff as your ruler. I have consistently found that it is the Scorpios who don't want to have Pluto pried from their cold, dead hands, which is, of course, very consistent with the obsession and obstinacy, of course, both come with Pluto. Anyway, I do think, I know this is going to tie into other things, but because the way that a lot of us learned astrology through 20th century texts, some of the traditional planets lost some of their cool, and that cool was given to these outer planets. And so you might have someone who's born with the sun in Aquarius who is very unusual. And so they're like, well, that's what Uranus means, right? And so how could I be ruled by Saturn if I am outside of social structures, right? And we'll get into sort of what has been stolen, what fire has been stolen from the traditional planets. But I think that's a part of people's resistance, is that, well, I can't describe what I see using what I know about the traditional planets.
Right, because of the sort of taking of significations from the traditional planets and applying them to the outer planets. And additionally, I mean, it's gone even further than that, where the nuances and the deep sort of meanings of some of the inner planets have been watered down or lost to some extent. And the outer planets oftentimes become the main focal point in many forms of modern astrology, to the detriment of I think, the understanding of the traditional seven planets. So that in some forms of astrology, it's like it's almost entirely predicated on certain outer planets, like, you know, evolutionary astrology and the, you know, emphasis on Pluto, for example. So part of what I think is happening recently and part of what we're doing here is just reacquainting people with the subtlety and the nuances and the importance of the seven traditional planets. And when we say seven traditional planets, of course, we're referring to and we're including in that the sun and the moon, the two luminaries, as planets as well. And so going back to basics, in terms of the original meaning of planet, I think you had made a point about that in terms of what the term planet means, right, Kelly?
Yes. As far as I understand it, the word planet describes a wandering star. And that's to differentiate the planets originally from the stars that appeared to be fixed, which we would call fixed stars in modern astrology. And the wandering planets, or the group that we use as planets and has been used as planets, moved much more quickly than the fixed stars did. So they were brighter and more mobile. And I think that's part of where their original, the fixation that went to them originally came from.
Sure. If you go out and you look at the night sky, like last night, actually, I was coming out of someplace with Lisa, and we looked up and we saw the full moon, which had recently taken place in Virgo, but it took place right next to and in conjunction with Jupiter.
Yes.
So if you looked up into the night sky, you could see a really bright moon, and next to it, you could see this really bright star hanging out right next to the moon. And that star is actually not a star at all. It was a planet. It was the planet Jupiter. So over many centuries, ancient sky observers noticed that there was this group of stars that actually moved around, unlike the rest of the stars, which stayed fixed in the night sky. And so they became known as the planets or as the wanderers. So here, though, we get to the fundamental question, which is, where did the basic meanings or significations of the planets come from? And if somebody was going to invent astrology all over again from scratch, let's just assume you're trying to invent astrology from scratch and you have none of the prior tradition or none of the prior meanings or knowledge of anything, you know, how would you come up with the significations of the planets and what would be your starting point? So a lot of people in modern times, especially in the past 30 or 40 years, oftentimes start with the mythology or with the name of the planet and any sort of associations or cultural associations that there are with that name or with the designation that's given to the planetary body or other celestial body. But one of the things I found interesting, one of the things that other people have found interesting as well in looking at some of the ancient texts, is that mythology doesn't come up as frequently and is not referred to or resorted to as commonly in order to explicate the meanings of the planets and other celestial bodies as one might assume if you're approaching it as a modern astrologer, where that's oftentimes one of the first things that people refer to. So, you know, in modern times, mythology is sort of a core element, but in ancient times, if you look at, for example, the translation of Valens, he's not saying, you know, the sun rules the intellect because of its association with the Greek god Helios. He just has other conceptual or theoretical rationales for why the sun is associated with the intellect that don't necessarily have anything to do with the god who is sort of associated or who shares a name with that celestial body. So that's an important point that I wanted to mention. That's partially sort of a hobby horse of mine because I feel like the use of mythology, because it's been assumed and projected back and assumed that that's always been a core component. It's sort of, people have sort of gone nuts with it over the past few decades and applying that and perhaps over applying it in order to get to the meanings of things instead of, you know, doing it the old way or doing it the original way, which I feel started originally with an observational component of what does that celestial body look like, or what kind of, you know, visible properties does it have that might be relevant in its interpretation? Do you guys have the same reservations in that way about mythology, or how do you feel about mythology in terms of how it's applied to astrology and the planets in particular?
Well, I have a couple thoughts on that. One, you know, in the text which you're referring to, they don't call that planet Jupiter or, you know, Zeus, right? They call it the star of Zeus.
Right. They use the possessive
form. Yeah. This is, you know, this is a body which belongs to this god, right? So even there we have some distance. It's not a direct identification, right? And so just using words that way indicates that there's a relationship, but it's not identity. Another, I think you can overuse it. But the significations of the traditional planets and the Greco-Roman deities, which they share names with, are generally pretty good. You won't go terribly afield. I feel like that strategy starts breaking down as far as reliability goes as soon as you get into the more recently discovered bodies.
Oh, yeah, you made that point about, I think it was like Neptune in the last episode, right?
Yeah, well, Neptune and Uranus, Neptune's the worst. it has nothing to do, it has almost nothing to do with the with that Roman god, except that it seems to have something to do with water. That's like basically
the only thing.
Yeah, it's so not an angry, rapey male sea god, right? That's not what Neptune transits bring you at all. Whereas with the traditional planets, not too far off. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the traditional planets get their god names through a process, largely through a process of syncretization between Greek and Roman god names and earlier Mesopotamian god names for those planets. And because the Mesopotamians had a very astrally focused religion, they were actively thinking about which deity, you know, which god forms, which deities coincided and made the most sense with various bodies, right? And so the names for the traditionals come out of that many hundred year long project, whereas our modern ones come out of a debate among astronomers who are not sky priests of the same caliber.
Right, and who were like a hair's width from naming Uranus like George, right?
Yeah, well, and then they called it Herschel for a while.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, George and then Herschel and then Uranus.
And then another good piece of evidence for this is even though, I mean, the Tarnas school and students of Tarnas, I think, have been guilty as other modern astrologers of the mythology, the overextension of mythology to new bodies, especially recently. But Tarnas even himself has made that argument that Prometheus is a better myth to be associated with Uranus than the myth of Uranus to some extent. And so even there, you can kind of see this tension in modern astrologers sometimes who apply the myths to the planets and recognizing that in some instances, just because this name was sort of arbitrarily applied to this celestial body by astronomers does not necessarily mean that it's fully evocative of the full range of meanings or significations of the body astrologically.
Yeah, I actually that came up in conversation in a reading I did very recently. I'm talking about Uranus and stories, and Uranus doesn't have many stories. Basically, Uranus has his main story is when he got his nuts cut off. Right. And that's not what we use the planet Uranus for. We don't do that to determine whether or not the native will have their genitalia removed.
Oh my gosh.
Right. Like, there's just not a whole lot there. So I personally agree with Tarnas on that particular point. And, you know, sure. And I've said, like, you know, Dionysus is a better Greco-Roman model for Neptune, if you want to go Greco-Roman.
Yeah.
So
the point about the benefic, malefic, and the light and darkness in terms of the traditional planets.
Yeah.
That may be a really valid point.
I think that's really the core of, in actuality, where the significations of the planets primarily come from. And the conceptual and theoretical starting point is this use of contrarities or of opposites in order to determine significations. And the general point is that in order for something to mean something or to signify something, if you're trying to create a conceptual system, like you're trying to create astrology from scratch, and you're trying to come up with a system of meanings, then if something is going to mean something, then you have to have something that means the opposite or that signifies the opposite or like the antithesis of that. And this is, I think, where benefic and malefic becomes the best starting point for that, because it derives from a fundamental observational component, which is that if you look in the night sky and you observe the planets, you'll see these two groups. One of the groups is Venus and Jupiter that appear very bright as very bright, sort of white shining stars. And then you'll see Mars and Saturn that appear sort of darker and more muted and kind of murky, where Mars is reddish and Saturn is kind of brownish.
Yeah, they're kind of dusky.
Right. So this immediately sets
dusky
up
is a good word. Dull this sets is up the a, word.
sets up a contrast between two groups of planets, which is the fundamental distinction of benefic and malefic. And from this, the astrologers seem to have started deriving contrasts and opposites, which included things like moral opposites and the application of, you know, good versus evil in this sort of, you know, if you're contrasting scenarios or actions, like good actions versus bad actions. And that's actually part of what the names for benefics and malefics derive from, is that the Greek term for benefic actually originally meant good doer, whereas the term for malefic meant evil doer or bad doer. But it also invokes subjective opposites in terms of experiences. So the experience of events subjectively in a person's life, where the benefics tend to be associated with subjectively positive events, and the malefics tend to be associated with subjectively negative events. So, for example, subjectively speaking, people usually prefer health, and they usually do not prefer illness. So that becomes a basic sort of contrast or opposite between benefics and malefics. Life versus death, good versus evil, sickness versus health, and so on and so forth.
So I want to jump in with just one point about moral polarities,
sure,
about good versus evil and good doers and bad doers. When we say good or evil, it is absolutely impossible to detach those terms from the, let's say, 1500 years of Christian framing of those terms, whether Catholic or Protestant or whatever. Which, you know, our culture exists, or at least was birthed out of a framework where there is an extreme moral polarity, like, you know, literally God and the devil, right? When people in that broadly Roman Empire region, or, you know, in the Hellenistic era, very few of them were coming out of a cosmological framework where there was an absolute good and an absolute bad. And so I think, you know, one of the things that I see when people try to think about malefic and benefic is they often immediately associate it with these moral extremes that come out of a monotheistic tradition. And that's not the frame, that wasn't the framing of the idea of good and evil in the culture that actually produced astrology and produced these terms. You know, it's a much more relativistic, much more, pantheistic thing. You know, the underworld wasn't hell. There was the part of the underworld where you would get fucked up if you were naughty. But there was lots of other areas, right? And sure, the gods were up in the heavens, but, you know, they were kind of shady sometimes too. You know, it's a much more mundane good and evil, right? Like you said, like I had one of the ways that I teach it is, it's the difference between a good day and a bad day. Right, which is not morally absolute. It's not an evil day filled with the power of Satan. Right, it was just like, oh, that was a hard day. Right, no, oh, this was a great day. You know, I got rewarded for my things on this day.
Right, yeah, in connection with the sort of subjective, the category of subjectively conventional values.
Yeah.
So some of the, in line with that, some of the oppositions that I sort of extracted or pulled out from this translation of Valens that I did, where he's contrasting the benefics and the malefics and what they signify in order to give you some idea of the polarities or their opposites that they're focusing on, because this becomes how they come up with some of the basic significations, is by having certain overarching concepts like benefic and malefic and categorizations as applied to the planets. And then they start saying, well, if, you know, this planet would signify this, then this other planet would signify this. So, for example, Venus signifies love, whereas Mars is said to give signs for or signify hatred. Jupiter signifies freedom, whereas Saturn signifies imprisonment. Venus signifies the acquisition of additional property, while Mars signifies the taking away of one's possessions. Jupiter signifies wisdom, while Saturn signifies ignorance. Jupiter signifies the begetting of children and childbirth, while Mars signifies abortion and Saturn signifies childlessness. Venus signifies marriage, while Saturn signifies those who are unmarried or widowed. And finally, Venus signifies friendship. Jupiter signifies alliances, while Mars signifies separations of friends and war. So those are some of the contrasts. And these are extremes because in ancient texts, they tended to paint things in terms of extremes. And then you were supposed to infer or figure out what the middle ground was. And Valens several times says there are instances in which the benefics can be, you know, not positive or can be counterproductive. And there are instances where the malefics can be constructive or even positive, depending on other conditions and how they're placed in the chart. But this, at least with the basic sort of binary distinction of benefic and malefic, allows us a starting point to start extracting some basic significations based on just polarities or based on contrarities.
It's really helpful, particularly with the idea of begetting of children and childbirth versus childlessness, the Jupiter-Saturn paradigm. It sounds very extreme, and it is, but working with clients, there is a level of gray area, say around fertility, but there are some charts that are extremely fertile or charts that are extremely barren. And if you're going to have, you know, these experiences in life, then of course we do need these extreme versions of the planets. So, you know, Jupiter in a very good condition, the one example, client example I'm thinking of, say, Jupiter in Pisces conjunct Venus, with Venus being the ruler of the fifth house, we get easy conception, easy birth, multiple children. So, you know, that's what you're saying, I guess, Chris, about the gray area, that, you know, an extremely good Jupiter can be extremely positive on some of these topics, and an extremely difficult Saturn can be extremely challenging, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You first have to establish the extremes. And then once you've done that, you can establish what the middle ground is or what the gray area is. And that's where this sort of discussion gets stopped before it can really take place in modern times, because the counterpoint usually against benefic and malefic is, well, what about all these people who have middle ground experiences with Saturn, where Saturn's kind of constructive? Or what about these people that have middle ground experiences with Jupiter, because Jupiter is not well placed and therefore it signifies excess or things like that. And they say, therefore, benefic and malefic is a useless distinction. And that's such a false sort of position to take, or a misleading position to take, because, you know, you're taking instances in which those planets are not placed in their extreme situations where they could be extremely positive or they could be extremely negative, and in which they coincide or correlate with those sorts of experiences. And then you're extrapolating from that and sort of rejecting a useful distinction just because there are middle of the ground sort of scenarios. Anyway, so the first step, I think, and that's where benefic and malefic is a useful starting point, is just establishing what the most extreme manifestations could be. And that really runs the full gamut of human experience in all different areas of the life, whether it comes to relationships or having children or career or friendship or family or what have you. There's a huge spectrum of different positive and negative experiences, and you really have to identify the full spectrum before you can really come to an understanding of what the planets could mean, especially in when contrasted with each other. So that's a good starting point, benefic and malefic. After that, I think this theme of contrarieties can be opened up even more. And in some of the texts, like in Retorius, you see them trying to contrast the planets with each other through different schemes. Like, for example, the domicile assignments or the traditional rulership schemes, where the two luminaries, the sun and the moon, ruling Cancer and Leo, are placed in opposition to the two signs that are ruled by Saturn. And so there you start getting different contrasts between the sun and the moon, signifying things like light and warmth, opposite to Saturn, signifying things like the cold and darkness. Or you get other assignments like Mercury's signs opposite to Jupiter's signs, or Venus's signs opposite to Mars's signs. So this draws out additional polarities that are not necessarily just the benefic-malefic polarities, but they can be more nuanced than that. So that's a good starting point. Other considerations that are sometimes taken into account are things like Ptolemy's basic natures of hot, cold, wet, and dry, and the sort of temperament model that I know you've done a lot of work with, Kelly, when it comes to the planets. And that's something that you found really useful, right?
It is really useful. I guess I'm at that age where part of my client practice does focus on this fertility side of things. But even in terms of the psychological connection of, you know, someone who's got a dry tone or a wet tone to their personality, it's hugely descriptive. And I think it's one of those things that's really lost in our modern approach with looking at the planets. We don't think about the moon as being cold and wet and moist. We just think about it as having to do with emotions. But somebody who's got a very lunar personality, maybe the moon's on the ascendant in a water sign, for instance, they're going to have, even in their physical body, but as well as their psychology, that idea of togetherness or joining, which is it's very much what wet planets or wet influences do. And I think it's significant, and Ptolemy does talk about it in Tetrabiblos. He sort of describes it, the heading that I think is most useful is under the influences of the planetary orbs. You know, the sun is found to produce heat and dryness. The moon principally generates moisture, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea, just as you're saying, is to define the core quality of each of the planets according to whether it's hot, dry, cold, wet, and then to infer or develop, you know, personality traits or life possibilities. You know, if your career has a very dry quality, dryness can be a bit thin on the ground or a bit barren, whereas wetness can talk about the generation qualities. So there's a lot that you can extrapolate just from those basic concepts, I guess.
And I actually have a note that I took it's funny because I have it in front of me, but it's from your lecture that you gave at ESAR, I think like a year and a half ago, and it's written on like a piece of note paper from the Sheraton Hotel. But you had really good keywords for hot, cold, wet, and dry. You said hot is about movement, cold is about slowness, wet is about cohesion, and dry is about separation. And I'm not sure if that was like directly what you were saying or if I was inferring those qualities from your talk, but I thought those are really good keywords for understanding those basic natures just on their own, and then by extension applying those potentially to the planets in terms of those being powers of the planets from which you could derive other significations.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, you think about someone, we talk about Saturn being a planet associated with the idea of the hermit. Well, Saturn is a very dry planet, so it creates separation, or it's an independent or self-contained kind of quality. Absolutely, it's a hugely rich study for anyone who does want to dive into that side of things more.
Sure, and that's definitely something that Ptolemy, at least in terms of ancient texts, really was maybe not the originator, but he systemized it to an extent that it may not have been systemized before. And then in the medieval tradition, they really went to town with that sort of Aristotelian approach.
They did.
And used that as the basis for deriving a lot of other significations from the planets. So so let's see. There's also other things that you have to take into account in terms of not just understanding the universal meaning of a planet, but also some of its individual significations, like sect, the distinction between day and night charts that I've talked about many different times on the show before in the past. So I'm not going to go into it too much here, but that's important because of the role, the modifying role that it can play in altering the benefic or malefic functioning of a planet in a chart. And in terms of the spectrum of, you know, extremely positive versus extremely negative significations coming from individual planets. There's also other considerations like being under the beams, being too close to the sun within 15 degrees of a conjunction, thus obscuring the light and the significations of that planet, like Austin was talking about earlier. There's the distinction between being a morning star planet versus an evening star planet, which is when a planet rises before the sun on the day of the native's birth versus sets after the sun on the day of the native's birth. There's other considerations like speed and whether the planet is moving faster than its average daily motion or slower than its average daily motion. And then finally, there's a whole other complicated set of what's called the bonification and maltreatment conditions, which are seven specific conditions whereby the benefic planets and the malefic planets can either affirm and say yes to what other planets want to signify, or they can deny and say no to what other planets want to signify through their configurations and relationships with those planets. So all of this falls under the general rubric of studying planetary condition, which is kind of a complicated topic on its own. But I wanted to mention some of those really briefly, just to be clear that there's a bunch of stuff that would have to be taken into account in terms of a more, as part of a more nuanced discussion about the basic significations of the planets that obviously we can't cover in an hour-long episode. So let's back up, though, and maybe just go through the planets individually or quickly and talk about some of their basic meanings and how we conceptualize them on their own. Do you guys want to start with a specific one?
We could go in ascending. We can go in ascending Ptolemaic order if we're going to be traditional. We could go from the fastest to the slowest.
Let's do it.
Okay. Well, that's in the episode art for this episode. That's actually how I have it laid out, starting with the moon. So that would be a good starting point. So the moon is sometimes used as a starting point in terms of what Austin said, the ascending Ptolemaic or ascending Chaldean order, where the moon is first because it's the celestial body that's the closest to us, and it's the one that moves the quickest, since the moon will orbit the Earth and do a complete sort of trek through the zodiac over the course of a month. So it's pretty fast, spending only 2.5 days per sign. So what are some of the basic meanings of the moon then that are derived from that? One of the first and primary ones that Valens actually mentions is because, and that all ancient astrologers mention, is that because the moon is the celestial body that's the closest to us, to the Earth, that it primarily becomes associated with the body and the physical incarnation of the individual, because that's what we're doing here. That's what's happening here on Earth, is that we're all alive sort of in physical bodies, living out our physical earthly lives.
Right. So the moon is associated strongly with the tides of generation and corruption, right? The coming into being and passing away of the bodies of things, right? And that is, in a sense, that is the closest planetary sphere to us, right? That's what we see. We see bodies emerge and then we see bodies decay. Right. And so that is the fastest moving and most impermanent thing. And that impermanency, is that a word? Impermanency?
it works. No.
Yeah. Right. That the constant change which the moon evidences through her phases is a big part of the core symbolism. Right. Things are always changing. Right. And the moon rules those things which always change. On a psychological level, one of those things is mood, right? Like our moods are constantly changing. I feel like this, and then I feel better, and then I don't know, then that happened, right? And so the moon rules those things which move at her pace, right? And so, again, like you said, Chris, she only spends 2.5 days in a sign. And so, those things which are, which are wishy-washy or back and forth, those particular parts of us are what she rules, right?
Right. And this is contrasted with the sun, which they tend to associate with light and with more of a sense of permanence and the things associated with that, such as, at least in Valens, the second century, things like the soul and the intellect, which he then is contrasting with the moon, which is also emits light at night when it's visible. But one of the interesting things is he says that it possesses a counterfeit light, this observation that the moon is reflecting back the light of the sun. And in some sense, then there's a almost a counterfeit misleading isn't the right term, but a sort of counterfeit nature to some of the significations of the moon. So the moon's association with the body is partially a contrast, at least in the second century, with the body being something that, eventually it doesn't have permanence, that grows old and changes and eventually dies, versus what they're contrasting the sun and things associated like the soul and the intellect with, which they view as something more permanent or something more real and sort of eternal in some sense.
Yeah, and more enduring. That's a theme through classical philosophy, which permeates astrology in a lot of ways. is, you know, what is permanent and, you know, what is fixed and permanent and what is constantly changing. And that which endures longer is generally considered to have more ontological value. It's more real, right?
Right.
And, you know, if we're looking at that, we could say, okay, sun and moon, right? Just on a very simple psychological level. If the sun, sun is identity, who I am, which is we're not going to try to define identity further than that because it's a huge topic, but we can say, okay, this is who I am. And then the moon is, this is how I feel right now, right? Like, I could use a snack. Right. I could use a snack is not an enduring feature of one's identity.
Hopefully not.
Right. And so, you know, and both are obviously necessary to describe the human condition, but we do have the constancy of the sun contrasted with the inconstancy of the moon.
Sure.
And you see that too in the physicality or the visibility, that the moon is varying in shape and size almost from one night to the next. Whereas in contrast to that, the sun is much more steady, particularly in terms of its speed. So part of, again, that idea about permanency or enduring with the sun has a more stable movement, if you like, whereas mm-hmm. the movement of the moon is much more in flux or constantly changing. And again, we get that idea of the moon ruling those things like mood and also the mind, you know, the thoughts that flicker through the mind. Because they're constantly in flux, just like the moon's shape is.
Sure. Let's see. And in terms of other significations, I'm just looking at some of the ones I got from Valens, since that's what I've been focused on. But he lists things, some of them are common that modern astrologers still associate. So, for example, he says the home and housekeeping are two of the significations of the moon. Let's see, the queen, the mistress of the house. But he also mentions other things that are a little different than modern astrology. For example, he associates it with he associates the moon with travel because it's moving yes. so swiftly, as well as wanderings. And then he also has the body parts. Of course, that's a whole separate topic, the planetary melothesia, which is the assignment of either planets or signs of the zodiac to different parts of the body. And the moon is said to rule the left eye, the stomach, the breasts, and other things, depending on what system of melothesia that you're using.
I think the traveling is really important because that's something you don't get in the modern texts on the moon because of the movement. And the other piece is the connection to the mind or thinking or even language and communication. There are some references to do with the moon having, you know, the idea of the written word being a sacred symbol and this idea of the moon god Thoth being the god of scribes. So there is a connection to language, if you like, or expression or communication that I don't think we get in the modern theories or thoughts around the moon.
I mean, that becomes a little bit more controversial in terms of different sources just because of their there's an issue there. And I was trying to work that out where the Egyptians originally associated Thoth with the moon. But then in the Hellenistic period, through the syncretism, cultural syncretism, they merged the Egyptian god Thoth with the Greek god Hermes into sort of the same sort of deity or sort of mythical figure. But the Greeks associated Mercury, the planet Mercury, with Hermes. And so Thoth then started becoming associated with Mercury as well. And so in Valens, at least, he associates speech and writing with Mercury. And then he associates the mind and the intellect with the sun. So there becomes, whereas in the Indian tradition, they definitely do associate the moon with the mind.
Yes.
So there becomes like different traditions and different, depending on what symbolic sort of system you're using and what references you're using, there's sort of some disagreement in some of them.
Yeah. With the Thoth thing, you have to consider why and how Thoth was associated with the moon. There wasn't an identification. Thoth was responsible for creating calendars for sectioning off and dividing time. And if you're trying to divide time after you do day and night, which everybody does, which even animals understand, your first you know, your first mathematical division of time is going to come about by tracking the lunar cycle, right? And so the moon, in a sense, gives us the gift of the first calendar, right? And so it's in what we could say is a very mercurial mode that Toth is tied to the moon. It's not just like, oh yeah, he lives in the moon. It's, you know, it's in that very specifically intellective, numerical way that he is tied to the moon.
And additionally, another category which shouldn't be overlooked as well is the people or like family members associated with the planets. So the moon is commonly associated with the mother. Valens also associates it with the nurse and with the older sister. But also the moon sometimes is said to signify like females in general. And that's, I mean, maybe we can go into that. I mean, one of the basic things surrounding that, I think, is they're associating the sun with males because it emits light versus the moon with females because it's seen as receiving the light of the sun. And so they're drawing a distinction between sort of this active component versus a receptive component.
And that distinction seems to be active and receptive. You do see that with sort of what is referred to as more masculine types versus more feminine types.
Right. And that gets applied in, like Christopher Renstrom and I went over this section in Ptolemy at one point where he deals with like human sexuality, and that Ptolemy has this interesting almost like spectrum of human sexuality depending on whether a person has an excess of planets that are quote unquote masculinized or quote unquote feminized in terms of where they fall in terms of conventional societal sort of like gender roles and gender expectations. So it's interesting because some of this on the one hand is very traditional in terms of the strict sort of distinction between masculine and feminine in finding significators, but then there's also this other element where it's much more nuanced than it might seem at first and sort of much similar to some modern sort of gender theories than you might expect.
Mm.
All right. So in order to keep this moving, so we talked about the moon. We talked a little bit about the sun. Do we want to make a few additional statements about the sun?
Sure. You know, one of the traditional significations, which doesn't get talked about a lot, is the sun's association with intelligence, right? Like that's a core signification in the Hellenistic texts, whereas it's not something which is as widely discussed or even discussed much at all in 20th century astrology. And so, you know, on a very simple level, the sun lights things up so you can see them. Right. The sun is intimately tied with the ability to look and to see. Right.
Right. To illuminate things.
Right. You're like, oh, there it is. Right. And suddenly that is part of your intelligence. And so that's actually. Yeah. What's interesting is the intelligence, when people say intelligence because of the let's say bias, or at least the framework of our culture. People usually think of intellectual gymnastics or cleverness as being intelligence. Whereas if we were to work on cultural definitions of intelligence from the Greco-Roman period, certainly, you know, cleverness with words and numbers is a part of it. But intelligence was a faculty of the soul or spirit rather than one's cleverness with words. Right. And so we have this sort of more central and to a certain degree more spiritual definition of intelligence, which is anchored to the sun in that period.
Definitely. And that actually is interesting because it becomes part of the reason why Mercury gets associated with acting as a go-between and as speech and letters and other things that are used in order to convey intelligence or to convey knowledge, Mercury, because Mercury becomes the closest planet or is the closest planet to the sun, it plays this role of sort of transferring things from the sun, from which represents knowledge or wisdom, to the rest of the planets. And therefore, Mercury is like not so much the gatekeeper, but he becomes the entryway or the
intermediary.
Or the conduit. Yeah,
the medium.
Exactly.
So yeah. There's a myth that I have to recite very briefly here. So this is an Egyptian myth which illustrates these concepts rather perfectly. So basically there's Ra, who's the god of the sun, and he's hanging out with Thoth, who here is associated with Mercury. And Thoth comes up to Ra and says, "Hey, guess what? I invented writing. It's going to be awesome. We don't have to keep everything in our heads. We don't have to keep everything in our heads anymore." And Ra says, I don't know. If people don't have to remember things, won't their minds get weaker? Isn't everybody going to get dumb now that we've invented writing?" And they go back and forth about it, speaking of the various virtues and vices which the ability to write things down will enable. And of course, what they decide on is, and this is a Greek term is used in the retelling of this myth, is that language, especially the written language, is a pharmakon, which is something which is a substance which is poisonous under some circumstances and medicine under other circumstances. And so you have Ra here as the sun advocating for raw intelligence. And Mercury's like, "Yeah, but, you know, what about writing? Like, you know, we can write this down. We can keep a list and, you know, I can record what you said." But of course, you can simply write things down incorrectly. You know, basically, it's the introduction of the telephone game, which is in a sense, the progressive corruption of the word. And that was, of course, very important to a lot of the Greco-Roman folks who saw, especially if we go a little earlier and we look at the Greek tradition of astrology, or excuse me, the Greek tradition of philosophy, the spoken word was considered to be much more pure than the written word. It's the reason we have dialogues, right? And then those dialogues are recorded. And this is in many ways an inversion of the idea of the holy word being primarily in a book, right? And so anyway, it's just this nice little piece about Mercury Thoth saying, "Hey, I have this clever supplementary method," and the sun is that raw and spiritual intelligence being ambivalent about that.
Yeah, that's a great, great story that goes along with that. So yeah, so the sun, let's see, mind, intelligence. I'm just reading through some of Valens' significations. He says authority, kingship, rulership, the father, master. Notable figures. So he actually associates celebrities or sort of famous faces with the sun. Parts of the body, he says the right eye, the heart, of course, and associates with the substance of gold. So the sun is commonly associated with gold. Any other points about the sun before we move on?
I mean, you know, a lot of those are just drawn from what it obviously is. Right. It's the center of things. It's super bright and shiny. You know, there's nothing more visible in the sky than the sun.
Right. You know, and I think that's really important because one of the things that you're doing sort of implicitly is you're drawing symbolic associations from, you know, that thing rather than and this is really it's really important point. But sometimes students of astrology don't get it until later on is that you're not drawing something from like a physical mechanism of like the sun is like making this happen, but you're drawing sort of symbolic associations from it, which can sometimes be kind of abstract. And I don't know how to articulate that very well right now because we're kind of getting, we have to keep moving through these, but I thought that was worth repeating. All right. So sun and moon, after that, maybe Mercury. Mercury gets associated with a ton of significations in pretty much every tradition of astrology. Doing this section of Valens was particularly annoying because his section on significations of Mercury was two or three times as long as the significations of the other planets. And that's partially because Mercury plays this vacillating role where he can go back and forth and he can be, you know, on one side or the other, and he can take on the qualities of other planets and sort of change them into something a little different. So as we've already said, he plays that in-between role of acting as an intermediary. So one of the first things that Valens associates with him is writings and speech, both in the sense of being sort of things that you use in order to convey something, in order to convey meaning, that you can use your words or you can use sort of, you know, a pen in order to convey things that are coming from your intelligence. But ultimately what Mercury is signifying is not, it's primarily signifying, you know, the conveying of those things or sort of transmitting them.
Yeah, one of the keywords I use for Mercury is translation, right? Like, yeah. If you have an understanding, you see something through your mind's eye, right? Sun. But then you have to somehow get that to somebody else, right? You have to translate that into words and maybe numbers. And another thing I wanted to say about Mercury in the context of this framework of contrarities is Mercury is his own contrariety.
That's great.
In all of these systems, Mercury is both benefic, both slash neither benefic or malefic. Mercury is both slash neither of the night or day sect, right? There, Mercury doesn't have contrarities in the same sense that the other planets do. There is the contrast with Jupiter, which is the smallest body versus the largest body outside of the sun, obviously. But he's lacking for contrarieties and so generates them within himself.
Right. Male or female is right. A really famous one as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's see. All sorts of other things. One interesting part of Mercury that comes up prominently in Valens at different points is this notion of Mercury as being about contesting things or things being up in the air or kind of like undecided. And I thought that was really interesting because it invoked some of like the things that modern astrologers associate with Mercury retrograde periods, for example. This notion of things being up in the air or being undecided or being up for dispute or contested. Mm-hmm. So disputation is one of the things that gets associated with Mercury, which is interesting because that's kind of contrasted with Jupiter's significations, which tend to affirm or stabilize things. And Mercury sometimes plays, as you said, Austin, an oppositional role with Jupiter in that it tends to sometimes destabilize or to contest or argue about things.
Right.
As one possible role.
Right. To a certain degree, any other planet asserts something and Mercury says, well, let's take a second and think about this.
Right.
Right.
Or plays the lawyer role, which is actually one of his significations as well, which is the sort of devil's advocate.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah, arguing of things.
Yeah, the generation of contrarieties where none seem to exist.
Right. That would be like the I want to say like the skeptic sort of role of, you know, asking, you know, the questions or asking the not delicate questions, but the inconvenient questions and things. Yes. Like that, or perhaps raising doubts where doubts hadn't existed previously.
Right.
Well, and so in the Picatrix, in the section where you're told how to identify the religion of somebody, you know, all the planets are identified with religions. Mercury's religion is atheism. And that's in an 11th century text.
Sure.
Yeah.
Everybody else has a faith of some sort. Mercury's faith is in a lack thereof, or in the disputation of the whole God thesis.
Yeah. There's some really interesting pieces in this, I guess, that you've been discovering, Chris, this idea that, where did I just highlight? One thing that we don't often think about with Mercury in modern astrology, the author of all things pertaining to the market and the craft of banking.
Yeah, that was huge. Huge. Mercury.
Huge. The mercantiles, you know, all the business and the contracts and the going to market and the negotiation. It's all Mercury.
Commerce.
Right.
Commerce, exactly.
And you think of like the bartering, like, you know, of, you know, you're at a market and you say, how much for this? And the guy says, you know, $100. And you say, how about $50? And he says, how about $75? And that sort of back and forth, kind of like almost, I don't know if dialectic is probably not the right term, but that back and forth sense, especially in a mercantile context, is very common for Mercury. And in fact, one of the final significations that Valens gives is he says that Mercury rules coinage and, yeah, basically money.
Yeah.
And things that are exchanged, you know, for services or for products, as well as the giving and taking of of money.
Well, and if you've ever seen a stock exchange floor back in the days before computers did a lot of the trading, you have got that incredibly mercurial environment where the comments and the information is literally flying around, and deals worth so much money are being done just in that bantering or that bartering, if you like.
Definitely. And it's quick. Like that's the other thing, very quick. Because Mercury is such a quick planet of all of the actual planetary non-luminary bodies. So not including the moon and the sun, Mercury is the fastest of the planets. So it gets associated with things that are very fast or very quick in all areas traditionally.
Very, very fast. His speed is he can get up to double the speed of the sun when he is going his fastest. So definitely. All right. Yeah.
Well, and he's not just the fastest, his speed is also the most variable.
Most variable. That's the other thing, is that if you understand how Mercury moves, I guess, through the ecliptic, he gets into little nooks and crannies that other planets don't even get near. And I think that's part of the symbolism that we see in the mythology of Mercury, the messenger.
Right. Definitely.
Right, where he's thought to have free reign over the world above and the world below.
Exactly, the only one that can go between all three.
Right, rather than being primarily settled in one abode.
Yes, yeah. Bernadette Brady years ago at a UAC did this animation of Mercury's movement across the ecliptic, and it was phenomenal to see visually how wide he gets to the edges of the ecliptic, where some of the other planets just don't go because their cycles are not variable enough.
And some of that gets tied into, like you were saying earlier, into this notion of irregularities with Mercury. And one of the statements that Valen says that really stood out to me is he says that it brings about all irregularities in our fortunes and many distractions from our goals. So notions of irregularities and distractions are common themes with Mercury.
Great quote. And distractions, I mean, it's like the monkey mind, right? You think you're doing something and all of a sudden a bright, shiny thing catches your eye and off you go.
Right.
All right. So there's a ton of other things we could mention with Mercury, but we should probably move on. So the next planet after that, we'll go to Venus. So Venus is pretty easy because a lot of its significations fall under this rubric of sort of unifying things or reconciling things. That was the two primary keywords that Schmidt used in the domicile assignments, taking that cue from Retorius, where Retorius was using the domiciles to act as sort of like a basic framework for understanding the contrarieties of the planets. And a lot of Venus's basic significations, and I found this actually recently in a translation that came out not too long ago of Proclus's commentary on the Timaeus. And he says something very explicit about Venus's significations actually coming from or being derived from this contrast with Mars. So Proclus says that Venus possesses the power of binding things together and harmonizing that which has been separated. And that which is separated, of course, being signified by Mars, since Mars primarily signifies things that sever or that separate, whereas Venus represents things that bind together or that reconcile or that unify.
Yeah, so, that word of unification is really important for Venus, I think.
Definitely, because almost not everyone, but a large chunk of the significations that many people use for Venus could fall under that general rubric. And that's every astrologer's goal, and that's something I've been working on for a long time. I realize that it's somewhat impossible, because when astrologers talk about the planets as archetypes, I think that's a good way to conceptualize them, that we're talking about, you know, when Valens lists 100 different significations for, or let's say 50 significations for Venus, it's clear that there's themes that are uniting and combining many of these significations, that there's some sort of overarching umbrella concept from which all of the other significations are being derived. And that's what the concept of an archetype, broadly speaking, especially in modern times, is this idea that there's this overarching core principle from which all of the manifold sort of individual significations are being derived from. But one of the things that I've found is that one of the frustrating things is that by its very definition, an archetype is something that is sort of transcendental, or it exists outside of or just outside of reality, to the extent that it can't be fully articulated because it encompasses all of the possible manifestations in the world of that specific concept. But by definition, it can't really be fully articulated. So you can try, and sometimes you can come really close by, for example, coming up with those overarching keywords like unifying and reconciling for Venus. And from that, you'll get, you know, 20 individual actual significations of Venus itself, like marriages and relationships and friendship and reconciling people that have had disputes and things like that, which are all falling under a very similar rubric, but you can never quite articulate the primary archetypal principle. So
it's very hard to do. So yeah, having some of these keywords that sort of summarize all the other themes can be helpful, or key concepts, I guess.
Right. So Venus. So Venus signifies things like friendship, marriage, relationships. Are there any other big major ones that I'm completely overlooking?
Oh, there's one that I found really interesting because of my interests, as well as the fact that it's not mentioned very often. But one of Venus's functions in the Greco-Roman era texts is to rule over ceremony and ritual in a religious sense.
Oh, lovely.
Which is basically theater. Right. You know, yeah. Venus already rules the arts, but people have a more spare definition of what religion is supposed to look like these days, you know, Catholics aside. And so, you know, like if we imagine any of the many religious and spiritual enactments that were going on during this period, there's quite a bit that's happening. Right. And if you look at, let's say, you know, magical or hermetic material, which describes how to create a ritual or ceremony, you know, it's like, well, you know, you got to use this color and this kind of cloth and this kind of incense. You know, it's rather artistic, right? And so Venus is uniting the aesthetic qualities associated with something in order to evoke it. And that word evoke is actually what I was thinking when you were discussing the difficulty in naming something which cannot be, or in showing something which cannot be shown, right? You cannot show the archetype, but you can evoke it by gathering together its many significations. And that is really the art of rituals, to evoke the invisible by means of the visible.
Yeah, and every student of astrology needs to understand that, is that you have to sort of memorize and come to an understanding of what the planet means by reading all these individual significations. And that's the way it's always been done, because of the impossibility of fully evoking or articulating the core overarching concept. In some instances, you can get close, but it's really the individual significations that you have to understand in order to understand the full range. So that one of the ones that you just brought up, Austin, is really important, because that is a core overarching concept, which is that Venus tends to signify things that are harmonious or aesthetically pleasing or aesthetically appealing.
Yes.
So from that, you get derived a ton of significations having to do with, for example, Valens says music making, sweet singing, pleasant sounds. But he also says things like refined arts, beauty of form, painting, embroidery, and all sorts of other things like that have to do with either harmony or things that are beautiful, basically things that are aesthetically pleasing.
Right. And so Venus reconciles us to the world of the senses, right? Yes. It's not those things which repel us from the material world, but those things which attract us to it and help us appreciate it.
Right. Which is probably just another form of like harmony itself, as opposed to what disharmony or things that are unharmonious.
Yeah, right. And that's also picking up the Venus-Mars polarity, if you like. The Venus has that magnetic attraction, not in terms of romantic attraction, but literally a force of attraction that pulls things in or binds things together, which is opposite to Mars, which has the strife or the discord, which causes that separation or that distance.
Definitely.
Right. Empedocles.
Just restate that.
Oh, I just said Empedocles. There's Empedocles has this doctrine of basically harmony and strife being the two powers yes. which make and unmake all things, and they're associated with Mars and Venus. So,
right.
But yeah, anything pretty, anything that we're drawn to, that's Venus magic or Venus at work, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes really funny in birth charts, because I have some good examples of that, of just sometimes people that have Venus in the first house, and the first house represents the body and the physical appearance, just being abnormally like physically beautiful or appealing, or like widely recognized as being appealing. And two of the examples I used for that were like Angelina Jolie.
Angelina,
and,
yeah, because it's right on her ascendant, very, very tight.
Right. And then for the male, it was Paul Newman, who was like really famous actor, Cool Hand, yep. He played in like Cool Hand Luke and a bunch of other movies. And he also has Venus in the first house, I think pretty close to the ascendant. So, yeah, and that can be, manifested in different ways. But basically, Venus ends up being the part of the chart where themes of beauty or harmony or reconciliation are sort of manifested in the person's life. All right, so that's Venus, and that sets us up for a nice contrast with Mars, which is often treated together with Venus in many different ways. And as I said already, and as Kelly emphasized, the idea of severing or separating or pushing things apart becomes a major theme with Mars and becomes sort of the core of many of its significations. So some of them, for example, just reading off some of the ones in Valens, and again, he tends to list the extremes that you understand what the extreme manifestations are, but he just says right from the outset, he says that Mars signifies violence, wars, robbery, screams, the taking away of one's possessions, yeah, banishment, exile, estrangement from one's parents, a lot of other things. He kind of goes on for a while.
A weird list of the Mars ones there.
But it's cutting and separating and aggravating.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, separations from friends, for example, is one of the things, like having a falling out with one's friends is contrasted with Venus, which is the bringing together of friends, or Jupiter, which is alliances between different people. Mars represents the separation of that. Venus, which indicated like pleasant, like harmonious sounds and music making. Mars's contrast is that in Valens, it says that he signifies verbal abuse and screams and insolence and lies. Lies is actually a really interesting one, where a lot of the like misleading significations and like lying and deception type significations have been sort of taken from some of the traditional planets and applied to the outer planets in modern times. But it's actually interesting how themes of like dishonesty and stuff, which planets those get assigned to in the traditional sort of approach. So one of Mars's significations is lying and things like that. Let's see, what else? Anger as a sort of emotional component to Mars, fighting.
Well, so one of the, to bring it back to temperament qualities, you know, one of my go-tos for Mars is that Mars rules intemperate heat.
Yes, right? excessive heat.
Right. The sun is warm, but Mars rules intemperate heat, right? And so if you look over things, like when people are intemperately heated, they get violent. But Mars also rules things, to quote Valens, such as attacks of fevers, ulcers, skin eruptions, and inflammations, right? That's what happens when the body gets overheated. It becomes reddened and unhappy. And so for me, like my two of my keywords for Mars are Mars cuts and burns.
Absolutely.
He separates by means of, you know, the blade, and then overheats and destroys by means of fire. And of course, fire is its own form of separation, right? Fire literally, if you set something on fire, that fire is literally separating that substance on a chemical level.
And that's interesting, because that's actually in the temperament model, that's part of Ptolemy's basic definition of benefic and malefic. And his distinction is, he said that the malefics tend towards extremes of hot and cold,
yes,
whereas the benefics tend towards moderation. And that's what leads to the experience of more subjectively positive or negative events with the things that they signify, is that the malefics tend towards extremes, whereas the benefics tend towards moderation. And it's typically in the extremes that you'll end up with scenarios that are experienced more negatively.
Yeah. I will just add to Mars so that I will add this to Mars so it's not entirely negative, is that type of extreme heat is necessary for the transformation of certain substances, such as all metals. And Mars's association with metal workers, and particularly iron workers, is as old as the text that we have. You know, there's no you can't create anything. You know, if you just like if you bring Venus to bear on a piece of iron and you like cool it gently, or the sun, you just put the piece of iron out in the sun, it cannot be transformed, right? And so Mars is the extremes of heat are necessary for the transformation of many different materials, some of which are psychic or internal.
Definitely. And in terms of other like positive manifestations, I know, especially in modern times, athletes and athletics are associated typically with Mars, but also the military and soldiers have long been associated with Mars, as well as other sort of things like that, or other professions in that area.
Absolutely. Surgeons and surgery, I think, is something else that's associated with Mars, where the cutting or the separating qualities of Mars are sort of put to productive use, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
You know, that would be good, like Mars and Virgo type signification, because of the attention to, you know, detail and the focusing on very tiny things that's necessary for Virgo. That's just something I was thinking about. Mars and Virgo would be a good signification for surgeons.
Yeah. And then you do see that with Mars triggers or transits or activations in clients' charts, that they go in for minor surgeries or minor procedures where things are being cut or cut away.
Yep.
Right. Definitely. Or in sort of negative end of the spectrum, you know, injuries and accidents, yes, and things like that, sometimes, yes, with Mars as well.
You cut yourself accidentally or what have you.
Yeah, just on a sort of dumb transit level, whenever Mars hits a critical point in my chart, I always burn myself on the stove, or taking something out of the oven. Like and it will sometimes have problems with inflammation or internal heat.
Yeah.
And I forgot to mention when you said that, Austin, I found this great quote from Iamblichus the other day, where he's talking about Mars and Saturn. He says, the emanation deriving from Saturn tends to pull things together, while the emanation deriving from Mars tends to provoke motion in things. However, at the level of material things, the passive generative receptacle receives the one as Saturn as rigidity and coldness, whereas the other, Mars, it receives as a degree of inflammation exceeding moderation. So he's trying to, this is in On the Mysteries, and he's trying to explain how the benefics and malefics are not, the planets themselves are not inherently good or bad, or the planets themselves are not trying to do evil, but it's just that in the sort of sublunar realm of experience, that the experience of excessive cold or heat as a broader symbolism tends to be experienced in a negative way.
Right. They're just too extreme for us, bro.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So moving along, since we're going over time here, and so we're getting up. If we finish in the next 15 minutes, we can still get the greater part of the forecast episode done. Does that sound good to you guys?
That sounds good. Sure. We've got Jupiter and Saturn left.
Yeah. All right, so let's jump on to Jupiter. So Jupiter is the so-called greater benefic. Venus is the lesser benefic, and then Mars is the lesser malefic, and Saturn is the greater malefic. Jupiter.
So we should say why they're lesser and greater, because there's a very clear reason. Those aren't.
Tell us.
Well, yeah. the lesser benefic, Venus, and the lesser malefic, Mars, are the two that move fast, and the greater are the two that move slow.
Right. And they're also even just like physically much bigger.
Yeah. Well, we have two that are the lessers are both inside the asteroid belt and they're both solid. We could walk upon either of them. Whereas the greater are both gas giants and similar in size and composition. So they naturally pair off once you've decided, you know, who's bright and who's dark. Yes. And then you can make that lesser, greater distinction really easily. I just wanted to bring that up because it sounds like some sort of pompous and arbitrary thing, but it's really lesser in that it, you know, those are faster and closer to us.
And I think that point about like being, you know, more physical or being gaseous sort of bodies is a great distinction, because I think that's going to be one of the next areas in like astrological research that hasn't been used as much as it could, which is just the physical properties of the planets now that we have the ability to investigate them.
Oh, yeah.
Because sometimes there's really interesting, and I've mentioned this before, I think in an episode, other episodes, like with Nick Dagan Best, just how sometimes the physical properties of the planets, when you look at them in the solar system, end up actually being surprisingly evocative of significations that astrologers already associate with those planetary bodies, even though we came up with those meanings, you know, long before we could actually inspect the planets.
Yeah. And just one more note on that. If we look at how the planets are grouped in sect, Venus, the moon, and Mars are all the three. They're the three bodies that are literally closest to the Earth, and you can walk on all of them. Whereas if we look at Jupiter, Saturn, and the Sun for the day sect, those are all huge things, none of which we could walk on because they're not actually solid.
Mm, interesting. And yeah, there's a bunch of things like that. At some point, I want to do a whole show on that, because there's another thing, like when Nick Dagan Best and I went to a planetarium when he was in town a few years ago, one of the things that they really focused on is this huge like gash in Mars that looks like it has like gotten a slice taken out of it or something like that. Because it has this huge like canyon or trench that runs through the planet. And I thought that was really funny, just given Mars's common association with, you know, cuts and with wounds and gashes and things like that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, and with it having, even though it's a smaller planet, its mountains are much higher than those on Earth. And if we're talking about skin eruptions, right, the skin of the planet is popped and scarred and raised and lowered in a way that is not harmonious, or is much less harmonious than our planet, for example.
Nice. Well, I think that would be a good sort of route to explore for people that are eager to look into some of the new sort of planetary or other celestial bodies that are being discovered in terms of trying to determine their significations. Anyway, so back to Jupiter.
Big, the biggest.
Yes, big. And that's actually that's a good starting point for the significations, is that a lot of Jupiter's significations are things that are big, or that are physically or literal or philosophically big.
Yes, it seems to rule things. It certainly is a dynamic trigger with transits, progressions, time lord techniques. Jupiter talks about increase or growth, or things becoming larger, or there being more, you know, doubling what you have, or increase. And literally, Jupiter is this gigantic thing in the solar system.
Right. And abundance, like Balance says, abundance, large gifts, and abundance of profits. So this idea of having a lot of something.
Yes.
As well. Okay. And so other things in Schmidt's whole thing, contrasting the domiciles of the planets, two of the main significations he came up with that I think were very good is the idea of Jupiter stabilizing, but also affirming or confirming things. It comes up very frequently in a lot of the significations of this notion of stabilizing things, like things that are either up in the air or things that are disputed become stable and become confirmed, or they become sort of affirmed in a way where Jupiter says yes to things. If there's a question about whether something will happen or whether things will come about, Jupiter tends to say yes to everything.
I think you go, Austin.
Okay. One of my go-to words for Jupiter is coherence. When Jupiter's not making something bigger, he's establishing coherence between the constituent pieces of it. So, for example, when we talk about Jupiter as being associated with, let's say, personal growth is not getting bigger. Personal growth is finding harmony between the different components of what you are, right? It's reducing conflict internally, which might allow you to get bigger or grow, but that internal harmony, or the creation of coherence within a given thing, is huge for Jupiter. And that's actually a precondition for growth, right? If something is out of proportion and its different pieces are not connected to each other, then more growth is not only unnecessary but counterproductive. You're just enlarging a problem. But Jupiter has this balancing function. This balancing function that is spoken of in lots and lots of traditional texts, but has been somewhat ignored over the last 100 years in favor of its power to biggin things. And it does biggin things, don't get me wrong, but that internal coherence is super important.
That's a beautiful point, Austin, about the balancing and the coherence.
Let's see. Other things. So valence gives significations like confirmation of good things, relief from bad things, being released from bonds or being released from imprisonment, freedom, wealth, abundance, payments, justice, alliances, knowledge. And he uses the term gnosis here, friendships with powerful people, and so on and so forth. All right. So let's see. I'm sure we're missing some things. Are there any other major themes, Kelly? Is there any other major themes we're missing for Jupiter?
Did we talk about the wisdom and the knowledge piece side of it?
Yeah, I think that's really important and it probably needs to be articulated because that's something that Valens really emphasizes is this idea of knowledge or wisdom, again, using the term gnosis, which is really important and perhaps we should expand on.
Yeah, no, you mentioned gnosis. That's true.
How do you contrast that? Like, how would Jupiter's knowledge or sort of wisdom contrast with, let's say, Mercury's, you know, similar associations with, I don't know, some forms of intelligence?
Well, I guess the difference is Jupiter probably represents the wisdom in the sense of knowing or understanding, perhaps in a fairly integrated or substantial way. I think Mercury's link to intelligence is perhaps a little bit more the ability to express that wisdom that might come from Jupiter or elsewhere. But that knowing or that awareness, I think that's more Jupiter rather than Mercury.
Definitely. So maybe the difference between like Mercury collecting a bunch of facts and like, let's say, having a whole collection of different facts, but then Jupiter actually understanding, you know, what's being collected or having some actual insight into the underlying working of things or some wisdom surrounding it versus just a collection of data, let's say data points versus understanding the data.
Data points would be totally Mercury, the collection of facts just for the sake of knowing things, whereas Jupiter would be more about, is there some meaning or context or purpose behind those facts and those data, or is there a way to tie them together in a bigger way? I think that would be the Jupiter piece.
Right.
Yeah. Jupiter asks, how do we use, so what does this say about life and how can we use this to make life better? Right. So we could assemble a number of facts about life, but then, you know, we can ask the sort of the classical philosophical question of, okay, and so how does this inform our definition of the good life as well as the way that we might achieve it? Jupiter is actually very application oriented. When we say wisdom, wisdom is something which is usually both sort of transcendentally true as well as actionable and applying to many situations. And I would also say, I think that wisdom in many cases is what arises when there is coherence between the many facts and experiences which are present in the mind. Wisdom is a sort of meta product of the experience that one takes in. And another sort of Mercury-Jupiter contrariety that I use when I'm teaching is if we're looking at sort of different ideas of passing knowledge, wisdom on. Let's use knowledge because it's sort of halfway between wisdom and facts, right? We have the sort of guru model where the guru, and of course, Jupiter is called guru in the subcontinental traditions, where it's like, let me try to pass my understanding on to you. And I have a lot of experience with this through Chinese martial arts and Taoism, where that's the model, right? But then we also have the university professor as Mercury as being the other style, where like you're supposed to go to class, read the facts, and then argue about it, right? And there are different ways of perpetuating knowledge traditions.
That's a really interesting point. And then that term for knowledge, the Greek term wisdom, is also the source of the term Gnostic for the Gnostic sects in the ancient world, including the Gnostic Christian sect, which was based around the idea that there was this underlying knowledge or truth that was like revealed to humanity that allowed them to be free or to liberate themselves. And the passing on of that knowledge or wisdom from teacher to student was part of the some of the mystery traditions, including the Hermetic tradition.
Right. And it's not primarily textual. The techniques are there so that you can have the experience of the direct experience of the divine. That's what the gnosis is. You know, things you can say about that are not gnosis, right? The gnosis is not primarily verbal, nor is it primarily textual, right? And that's what a guru is trying to pass on. He's trying to get you so you can see what he sees or what she sees. Whereas a mercurial knowledge tradition is a different thing. And of course, the two intersect and interplay, but there is a difference at that sort of raw or archetypal level.
That brings us back to, again, wisdom also being a good alternative, maybe translation of that, just because I think wisdom, that's a clear access point for understanding the difference of what you get with studying under a teacher where they've had years and years of experience and they've gone through they've run into the dead ends and they've found the things that work and the things that don't work. And in having that sort of experience of working directly through them, you gain the benefit of their years of wisdom and their own work sort of directly versus something that you read in a book and then you sort of have to work out on your own and you sort of have a collection of things in theory, but you're much less close to the sort of working practice of how this actually works in practice.
Yeah. And I know we shouldn't go on about this too much longer, but in some traditions, there's literally what they call direct transmission, where the teacher will literally zap you with, you know, the juice, where you literally just, you know, you get the abstract energetic component of the tradition, which is not the words that you can say about it.
Sure. All right. I think that's a good sort of closing down point for Jupiter.
The juice.
The juice of Jupiter. Love it. That's our hashtag.
Well, speaking of, that's relevant to some of the significations of begetting children and childbearing. It shows up very prominently then in the myths.
Indeed. Internally, it is the lord of semen, the womb, etc.
The juice and the growing. Love it.
Right. Listing the significations from Valens. And that's actually an area where I do wonder if, you know, because that's something very prominent in some of Jupiter's myths. And it's interesting that it shows up as one of the first significations of Valens, where he says the begetting of children.
Yes,
indeed.
But yeah, it's, who's to say? It's hard sometimes where there's just like symbolic things that make sense versus the mythology being what it is. So it's hard to say.
Well, a quick word on the temperament pieces of Jupiter. It's a hot and moist planet, which are the conditions required for growth.
Among other things.
Did that just get worse?
It did. It totally got worse.
Damn, I was really trying to be serious there.
Yeah, and so that's just real quick. You know, that's some people don't associate Jupiter with sexy at all. You know, modern astrologers. Nobody's like, ooh, look at that Jupiter. That's sexy. Right?
Little
do they know.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that stood out to me as well, as one of the first few significations that Valens actually gives for Jupiter is also desire and love and alliances. So there's other sort of Venusian almost type components that get tied in with Jupiter, or things that we might otherwise usually associate with Venus that come up in Jupiter as well. And that's true of other planets where there's different crossovers and there's different pairs of planets that sometimes share similar significations. That happens also for Mars and Saturn. It happens for the Sun and Moon exchange some significations. The Moon and Mercury have some similarities in their movements and therefore share some similar significations. There's different pairs where sometimes planets, when they overlap due to different categorical properties or just different observational properties, sometimes they'll share similar significations.
Absolutely. And I think in some ways that the particularly say Venus, Jupiter, they're both the benefic planets. So we get some of the good things represented by both Venus and Jupiter, but in a smaller or a larger scale way.
Definitely. All right. Well, let's move on to our final planet, which is Saturn, which is the furthest and slowest and dimmest of the seven traditional planetary bodies that can be seen with the naked eye. It represents the boundary, in fact, the point where you can't see any other visible planets. There are no other visible planets that can be seen with the naked eye past Saturn. So in some sense, it represents the sort of outer limits and this theme of boundaries or sort of walls or things that you can't go past becomes a very prominent theme for Saturn.
All right. Absolutely. And I think that a lot of that is just the physical placement of Saturn in the cosmos as we experience it directly. And that is hugely important. Over to you, Austin.
Okay. I want to read you guys a poem.
About
the children of Saturn. It's not very long. I think it nicely summarizes a lot of what we're going to talk about. Saturn
this,
is my
this
name.
This is from like a 17th century text or something?
Yeah, I sent you this. Saturn is my name. I'm first planets high above the earth. I am by nature dry and cold, and my works are manifold. In my houses firmly stand the goat and the waterman. I do much damage by my might, by sea and land, by day and night. My exaltation's in the scales, but in the ram my power fails. It's 30 years, harsh and malign, ere I come again to the same sign. My children are vicious, dry and old, envious, weary, wretched, cold, deep eyes, hard skin, their beards are small. They're lame, misshapen, depraved withal, traitorous, brooding, greedy, pale. They often find themselves in jail. They grub the dirt, dig graves, plow land, in foul and stinking clothes they stand, condemned to die or live in sorrow, sweat and strain or trouble borrow, always needy, never free. It's Saturn's children. There you see.
Nice. That's great. And that's funny because it really actually summarizes a lot of the significations that Valens gives in it. I'm surprised because that was in like the 17th century, right?
I think so. It might be a little earlier, but it's classic. That's why I wanted to read it.
Nice.
It is. It captures everything.
So let's see. So I'm trying to think of a starting point, but so restrictions, boundaries, things that you can't go beyond
which... Yeah, Saturn will say no to things. He will tell you you cannot go here. There is a barrier across your path.
Yeah, that becomes two of the primary meanings, the idea of rejecting things and excluding things and saying no to or negating things become really core concepts with Saturn.
Well, I would add to that, you know, there's this, one of Saturn's polarities is confirmation or denial,
yes.
Right? You go and you take the test to see if you can become a licensed therapist, right? And then you either pass or fail. And so the authority, you know, the Saturnian figure either confirms and says you're good enough, I guess, or you're rejected. You know, confirmation and denial. And I know we've all talked about that a lot with Saturn. And then I would also say another one of my favorite polarities with Saturn is inclusion and exclusion. A wall, a structure is always keeping somebody in and somebody out. And it's not necessarily better or worse to be on either side of that. But we have, you know, our human world is full of walls, right? And so when people that one of my not pet peeves, but I don't know what you call it, things that I keep talking about is people are like, oh, I'm an Aquarius. I can't possibly see how Saturn rules Aquarius. Okay. Well, Saturn rules exclusion. Are you on the outside of things? Welcome to Saturn. What defines outside and inside? It's a boundary. Saturn rules visible boundaries.
And it's hilarious also, if you go back and listen to our Saturn and Sagittarius episode, how we were taking some of those that symbolism and meaning of like boundaries and walls and all of that, and how that's really manifested in the past several months in two very different ways. On the one hand, you're talking about walls just now is making me think of a lot of the furor and the discussion over, you know, Donald Trump becoming like the leading candidate for the Republicans in the United States presidential election, and him talking constantly about putting a wall up between the U.S. and Mexico as a Saturn and Sagittarius type theme, where with Sagittarius, you have ideas of like travel and that which is foreign. And then with Saturn, you get ideas of like boundaries and like putting up walls and things like that.
Right. The possibility of denial of travel and movement.
Right. And then additionally, as we've talked about probably a lot at this point, but the immigration crisis and the things happening in Europe and the Middle East in terms of, you know, large movements of people and interactions of cultures and stuff going on in terms of that with Saturn and Sagittarius.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about how Jupiter and Saturn's meanings contrast with each other in a meaningful way. So one thing, for example, if Jupiter is growth or the beginning, Saturn is the limits of growth, right? Like right. Nothing can grow forever. You know, everything has a container to some degree, and it becomes useless or counterproductive to continue increasing in scale. And the very laws of physics treat things of a different scale differently, right? Like there's a reason we don't have house size ants. It's because the structure of an ant doesn't work on that scale. It works on the, you know, on the insect scale. And it's why people who are huge, you know, somebody who's like 8 feet tall, a lot of times they have a lot of health problems. Like the human body doesn't scale up super well.
So Saturn is boundaries and limitations. Sometimes those are ones that don't feel good and are annoying. And other times those are ones that are important for functional purposes and give us useful sort of boundaries and guidelines.
Absolutely. I think one of the words you used, Austin, containment, that containment can be a boundary that prevents you moving forward. It can also be a safety net that stops you hurting yourself or going into danger. So I think there's a potentially positive or protective quality to that side of Saturn too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, Saturn rules a lot of, it rules the erection of solid structures, which you can certainly be imprisoned within. But, you know, and so there's that negative experience of containment. But there, you know, there's also the being protected by the cold stone walls. Sometimes that's helpful. Sometimes it's necessary. And of course, we are in a sense all contained within the cold stone walls of our future crypts, right? Saturn is traditionally associated with death, which is the limit of all created things, or at least the visible limit of all created things. And Saturn's associated with with tombs. And of course, when we are dead, we are in a state of excessive coldness relative to life.
Mm. Right. Sort of diminishing of the heat and life of things.
Right. We are rigid and cold.
Let's see. Other significations. Another one that's useful and interesting is things that are long lasting.
Yes.
And things pertaining to like time and things related to time in general, but especially things that take a long time are often associated with Saturn, since there's this contrast between, for example, Mercury and the moon moving really fast at one extreme of the visible planets. And then Saturn is the other extreme of the visible planets, where it's moving extremely slow. It's taking, you know, the moon takes a month to go around the zodiac. Mercury takes, a year or less. And then Saturn takes 30 years. So right there, you get a contrast between different things that move very fast versus things that move very slow and take a long time. But also things that last a long time or things that have greater permanence in some instances.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the establishment of epochs or dynasties or legacies that are enduring, I think, is also symbolized by Saturn.
Definitely. Let's see. There's some negative significations that are more like psychological, and I think a lot of these are getting contrasted. So some of the other planets, like the sun, for example, indicates action and, you know, getting things going and movement. So sometimes the contrast with Saturn as the planet that rules the domiciles opposite to the sun or to the luminaries is in either inaction or sluggishness, like slowness in action. or sometimes not taking action when you're supposed to.
Right. I would say it also rule what you see by transit a lot of the time is Saturn describing periods of feeling stuck.
Yes.
Mm.
Feeling stuck or feeling like you're not moving as fast as you'd like to be moving, or you're stuck in place somehow.
Mm-hmm.
It also, Valen says, rules obstacles and undertakings. So things that come up that get in your way that either slow you down or that stop you or make it so that you can't proceed further on a certain path that you're trying to walk across. Psychologically, there's a lot of interesting stuff, even in early in Valen's, pertaining to depression, feelings of isolation, feelings of, he says, things like being sullen, being miserable, squalid is one of the significations he gives, which is interesting, I thought, in light of the poem that you read earlier, Austin, because squalid, or at least the Greek term I was translating as squalid, can mean both, it literally means dry or parched, which is one of the significations associated with Saturn, but by extension, it can also mean dirty or squalid. And by extension, it also has other associations such as being miserable or being dark or being gloomy. And I thought that was really funny because, like, Valens talks about Saturn also being clothed in black. So Saturn is like the original sort of goth of the planets.
Yes, it's the man goth in black.
Totally. Right.
There's also some interesting, I brought this up earlier because oftentimes this gets appropriated and sort of applied to Neptune. But in traditional astrology with the seven planets, Saturn actually had a lot of the sort of significations having to do with deceit. So for example, Valen says that Saturn signifies deceit, and those who conceal their deceit, or those who have a feigned appearance. So those who put on sort of like a false appearance.
So quick example, Bill Clinton is a Mercury Saturn.
It's like Mercury, Saturn, and Leo in like the 11th house.
Yep.
Correct.
And so, like, literally, I did not have sex with that woman. Like, he's known by a lie of national proportions.
Sure. And then that's actually interesting because I was watching an interview with Christopher Hitchens the other day, and it was old. It was from like 2000 or something when he wrote this book that was titled No One Left to Lie To. But he said it wasn't just that he sort of misinformed the public, but there were close, like, friends and associates that he told, you know, no, like Monica Lewinsky is just a crazy person or something like that. And he's to his inner circle said that was a lie. And then later he had to sort of come forth with that or be honest to his friends that, you know, there actually was something that happened with her. So that's interesting that you point that out. Let's see what other.
The one other positive side of Saturn that's in the Valens work here is this quote that he produces those who acquire great reputation, notable rank, guardianships, a couple of other kind of odd things like fathers of other people's children. But the great reputation, I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's this acknowledgement that when Saturn is well-placed and when it's in a day chart, when it's of the sect in favor, or when it's well placed by sign or configuration with other planets, it can indicate people that become eminent, that become authority figures, that become the administrators of that which belongs to others, which then gets extended towards things like the fathers of other people's children and things like that.
Mm.
Yeah, so there's definitely some very positive ones, and that's a point that Valens makes several times, that even the malefics have the potential to be constructive,
yeah,
under certain circumstances.
I often think of the sun as the king and Saturn as the prime minister.
Oh, that's a great way of describing it.
And I would also say, even though it's not in this set of significations, if we're going to contrast Jupiter and Saturn, I think actually I personally think both rule wisdom, but of a very different sort. Saturn rules that sort of wisdom, which comes about by being alone and cold and in a cell and meditating for years at a time.
The wisdom of introspection.
Yeah. Well, and of wrestling with, there are actually a number of meditative traditions where you picture your death.
Mm.
And then, you know, by envisioning it a thousand different ways, you come to terms with that limit of this life. And that gives you a psychological resilience, which very few people have. And so there's wisdom, but it doesn't look like the, you know, it doesn't look like the, it's not the realization of divinity and love that we might see through Jupiter, right? It's a contemplation of the dark rather than the light.
Or the, you know, that which you've learned as a result of setbacks or having paid your dues or having suffered, you know, hardship or difficulty and come out the other side of it.
Yeah, I think of Saturn as ruling over many ordeals that people go through, both intentional and unintentional. And the pressure of that refining a certain part of the psyche or soul.
And another part that's worth mentioning in that line is also the wisdom that comes from like loss or those that have experienced like loss or difficulty or hardship in some area, and the sort of insight that gives into perhaps the state of things in a pragmatic sense or perhaps just into the nature of the world in general as a sort of perspective, versus, you know, the more optimistic perspective, maybe contrasting like, let's say the optimism of Jupiter, the sort of unbridled optimism versus the more cautious or pessimistic or pragmatic sort of insights or wisdom of Saturn.
Yeah, I think of Saturn as corresponding to the concept of sobriety in a lot of ways.
Definitely. All right. Well, I'm sure there's many things. Are there any other really main points that we needed to touch on with Saturn that we didn't get a chance to?
I think that's a good cursory examination.
Okay. Well, we've come to what turned into a two-hour, supposed to be an hour, run-through of the seven traditional planets. So both of you, I think all of us, do sort of have had extended discussions on the planets and different things. Since I think this episode is going to be around for a while, maybe it'll be useful just to mention where each of us goes into each of these with more detail. And then in the forecast episode, we can talk that we're going to do next. We can talk about, you know, other upcoming things that we have going on. Where can people find out more information about each of you or where each of you go into more about the planets?
Well, last year I taught a month long class, which is about 6 hours, just going over the planets. People can purchase recordings of that on my website. In addition, I'm just about to start teaching a fresh round of basics classes. And we're going to start with the planets because that is where astrology begins. And the first class for that will be on March 19th, Saturday, March 19th.
Okay. And your website's austincopic.com.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Kelly, you've done stuff on the planets and even your temperament talks and stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. The temperament talk. I was thinking about what to share now. Yeah. The temperament talk. So I gave a lecture on that at ISAR in 2014. And that's actually available for purchase, the recording along with the accompanying PowerPoint presentation via my website. So from the main page, you hit the resources option and then lectures is the section right underneath there. We'll hit the lectures tab and it brings up all of my past conference lectures and the temperament one is there. In the last 6 months, I've given a lecture called Planets, Passions and Problems, where I go into some of those criteria around sect or speed, some of those special configurations that can strengthen a planet or kind of neutralize or weaken a planet. And actually Bill Clinton's chart is an example that I use in that lecture. And that lecture will be available in the next few weeks as soon as I come out of my kind of contracted non-compete period. I'm also teaching online classes at the moment. I'll be diving into predictive astrology starting later in the summer. So that info is also available on my website under the study tab. So that's kellysastrology.com for anyone who wants more on that.
Excellent. And then of course for mine, I'm working on my book, which I hope to have finished and out later this year. In the meantime, I'm not sure if I'm going to release the significations of the planets that I have, this translation, because it's for the book. I do have it as part of my course on Hellenistic astrology, which you can find out more about at hellenisticastrology.com. And that's primarily where I teach about the planets within the broader context of, you know, Hellenistic astrology and the broader systems that you can understand, not just the meanings of the planets, but also planetary condition and things like sect and visibility and bonification and maltreatment and everything else. So I would check out the course at hellenisticastrology.com for that. All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of this episode. Let's end this episode for now, and then we'll figure out what to do about the next one. All right. So any final words about the traditional planets from you guys before we wrap this up? Or any tips? How about this? Any tips for new students who are just learning astrology?
Oh, yeah.
And trying to develop an understanding of the meanings of the planets. Do you have any tips for those guys?
Well, I think I would suggest, if you haven't already done what Austin and I did in the beginning, which was start looking at the traditional ruling planet of the signs, that can kind of instantly and radically improve the accuracy, I guess, but also the depth with which you understand how the planets work. So if you're thinking about, you've got, you know, a Pisces on the midheaven or the 10th house, start thinking about Jupiter as an important planet to do with career, and working with that, sitting with that, reflecting on that and watching that can be a good way to get started.
Definitely. And that can be tough, though, also at the same time, because
it sounds simple, but it can take a long time to get your head around it.
Right. Just because the modern statements in many modern astrology books about the signs are often predicated sometimes on drawing significations from the outer planets. And so it sort of depends on what books you're reading. If you're reading a more traditional book, it'll be clear that they're drawing the significations more.
Yeah, I've got a book I'd recommend. Yeah.
Which one would you recommend
for that? It's actually Traditional Astrology for Today, An Introduction by Dr. Benjamin Dykes. It's really accessible, and there's a lovely little section in there where he looks at planets from a more traditional perspective, and I think it's a really good starting point for people.
Okay, nice. All right, any final words from you, Austin?
Oh, just that you can't know too much about the planets. You're never going to waste your time by studying the planets. Almost everything else in astrology comes back to the planets. They're really the root. And so if you don't know what else to study, like, just study the planets. Study. Study, contemplate, draw pictures of them, think about color coding schemes, like, you know, use all of your senses and faculties to approach the planets. You can't possibly know too much about them.
And something that Lisa and I did a few years ago when we taught a series we had with our local astrology group in Denver, we had this series that ran for a year where at each meeting we would have like a round table discussion, and Lisa and I had compiled extracts of it was like 5 or 7 different treatments of the significations of the planets from different eras, from the first century all the way through the 20th century. And we basically just read the excerpts of, you know, different astrologers and how they talked about what the significations of the planets were over the course of the past 2000 years. And that gave us a lot of really great insight into how astrologers conceptualized the significations of the planets and what some of the similarities and differences were over the course of the different traditions. So that's really what I would recommend, is try to find different books from different eras of the astrological tradition and just compare the significations. So, for example, Vadius Valens, the first chapter of his anthology for the early tradition from the 2nd century. And then you can do like the medieval tradition, like Bonatti or something, or you can just jump forward to William Lilly in the 17th century. That's a free book where you can look through the significations he gives for the planets. And then you can jump forward to the 20th century and look at significations like Stephen Forrest and his book, The Inner Sky, has a really good summary of the significations of the planets. Or you can go earlier 20th century and go to Eberton's The Combination of Stellar Influences as being a really good source text for giving the significations of the planets. And then jump forward, as one of the most recent ones that I'd look at would be Rick Tarnas's Cosmos and Psyche and the significations of the planets that he gives in there. And that'll give you a very broad sort of overview of the significations that astrologers have associated with the planets over the past 2000 years. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. So, yeah, thanks, Austin and Kelly, for joining me.
Anytime. Certainly.
All right. And thank you to the listener for listening, and we'll see you next time.